Before we get into today's episode, I just wanted to let you know that I am looking for 50 people with Hashimoto's. If you have been diagnosed in the last 10 years and you feel lost or confused about exactly what to do, then I want to invite you to join me for a free training call on Thursday, May 16th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, where I will show you how to support your thyroid for your thyroid type and your specific Hashimoto's triggers. You will also find out how to lower your thyroid antibodies and how to get to the bottom of all of your thyroid symptoms, the weight gain, the fatigue, the brain fog, the inflammation, the hair loss. Please go to inatoppler.com/Zoom call to register, and I will send you all of the call details. I only have room for 50 people, so please be sure that you register at inatoppler.com/Zoom call and get your spot right now. Meet Allison. She was dealing with brain fog and was constantly tired, and also felt like she was not getting a good night's rest. She was experiencing joint pain and felt much older than her chronological age. Allison saw multiple doctors, and they checked her B vitamins, her thyroid, her iron, but everything checked out. They did find that she had a positive ANA, which is anti-nuclear antibodies, but she was told that it could be anything and most likely that it's just nothing. When I met Allison, I rechecked her thyroid because I almost always find underlying issues there that doctors often miss. However, even looking at all the markers and checking them against the optimal ranges, her thyroid function was really okay. However, there are so many other things aside from thyroid that can lead to fatigue and the other symptoms that she was experiencing. And so I knew that we just haven't turned over all of the stones yet. After speaking to her at length, we figured out that her symptoms actually got worse after she moved to her new house. My sense was that it was something in her environment and that possible mold exposure was at the core of her mystery. We needed to figure out if there was mold, and if so, the best way to find it and remediate it while supporting her body in the process. Every year, thousands of people are told there's no explanation for their health concerns and no way to fix them. They feel frustrated, undermined, and lost. I know, because that was me before I figured out the actual causes and reclaimed my health. Now, I help others do the same. I'm Ina Toppler, and this is Health Mystery Solved. We just heard all about Allison's struggles. Join me on the show today to talk much more about this is Jason Earle, who is an indoor air quality crusader. He's the founder and CEO of 1-800-GOT-MOLD, as well as Mycolab USA, and he's the creator of the Got Mold Test Kit. Jason went from being a Wall Street whiz kid to America's top mold detective and connected the dots in his own health odyssey, implicating a moldy farmhouse that he grew up in. And like many of my guests, Jason's been featured in various publications and media outlets like the Dr. Oz Show, Good Morning America, and Extreme Home Makeover. Jason, I cannot think of a better expert to bring on for this case, so welcome.
Thank you, Ina. It's great to be here.
So it's not news to most of us that mold exposure is not healthy for us, right? But while we're aware of this, so many of us can be exposed and we don't even know it. And by the time we figure it out, there are various health issues and they really accumulate over time. And the mold field is really large and I feel like it's not really well regulated. And so with that comes a lot of confusion. And that's why I'm so excited to dig into everything today so that you can clear this up for us. So when it comes to mold, what is it about mold that's so bad for us? What makes it so toxic and makes us feel so bad?
First of all, I think that on a very basic level, mold is essentially the beginning of decay. Our bodies have visceral reactions to things that are decaying and have decayed. You just think about rotting food, feces, these kinds of things. There's a visceral repulsion to it. And I feel that this is just observational, right? This is after being in this 20 years, you start to think a little bit differently. And I believe that that's the primary reason why we have these incredible reactions to it. It's an evolutionary advantage, I would argue, potentially, that ultimately, it's part of the reason why women tend to have a better sense of smell, pick these things up more easily. And that, by the way, that's not just humans. That's also other animals as well. That's one of the reasons why we only used female mold sniffing dogs, because they had a better sense of smell. But that's an evolutionary advantage. And I think oftentimes, and by the way, the environmental sensitivities in general are not a weakness, as many people feel that they are, those people who have them and people who judge people who have them. I believe that that's actually a sixth sense of sorts, that these things are bad for everybody. And it just so happens that if you're sensitive to it, you got the message before they did. And if you listen to that, you can reduce exposure and have a healthier life. And so just because you experience discomfort doesn't mean it's a bad thing. People tend to think that pain is bad and pleasure is good. In this particular case, that signal is giving you a very important signal, and it's something to listen to.
Oh my gosh, I love this. I'm literally getting goosebumps just hearing you say this. It's, you know, my canaries in the coal mine. You know, I say something similar, like your body is telling you and you're actually hearing it, unlike all these other people that have no idea. So yes, I so agree with that.
And further to that point, I don't even look at mold as the enemy. I look at mold as a signal, because you get the benefit of it sends you the musty odor. It sends you the message, and it says something's off, something's imbalanced. I look at it much like inflammation in the body, where if you don't deal with the underlying cause of inflammation in the body, you'll go from acute inflammation to chronic inflammation, which is actually its own disease. The same thing goes with mold. Mold sends you the signal. If you don't listen, in other words, if you don't react quickly, it will get worse, because mold problems do that. That's what they do. They grow. And left unchecked, they grow to, they will ultimately take over the building. The job of mold is to take everything that was at one time living and turn it back into dirt. It's doing that very efficiently outside, and it's doing its job quite well when it's doing that with leaves and sticks and things like that. If it's doing that to your wallboard or your belongings, not so much. I would argue that mold is actually not the enemy. Mold is actually telling you that you've got an imbalance in your building, and your building is sick. And when you fix that, the building heals. And guess what happens also then? The people inside it heal too.
Right. Now, if mold is not the enemy though, what is it that the mold produces that makes you sick and makes the building sick?
Well, let's back up. What is the enemy is actually moisture problems. Moisture is the enemy of a healthy building. Mold is just the byproduct. Mold is the very predictable, natural byproduct of prolonged dampness. That's it. Mold spores are everywhere. They're just waiting there for the right conditions to be present. And so really, if I could just flip this, what you really have here, mold is a moisture problem. Mold is not the enemy. Moisture problems are. So that's the first part.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is that once mold begins to take hold, once the spore is on a surface, has the right conditions to germinate, much like a seed, it will send out shoots called hyphae into the material, release enzymes. It does the digestion outside of the cell. So we digest inside, it digests outside, and then extracts the nutrition from that material. And while it's doing that, it's obviously, you know, building structures to increase its ability to eat more stuff. And while it does that, it's creating colonies. And while it's digesting, it's producing, to overgeneralize, three different things. Number one, spores, which are the, you know, designed to go forth and prosper, right? Go find more places to go eat more stuff and do its job. And by the way, we really need that, because if you imagine if we just had all the dead stuff outside, we'd have piles and piles of trees. And that's why we have coal and oil and all that stuff, because at one time we didn't have fungi. And that's where that stuff comes from, deep within the earth. But we need that stuff now. Otherwise, we'd have lots and lots of dead stuff piling up. But the spores are abundant and they're ubiquitous, and they're a very important part of the whole health perspective or the health picture, because people tend to react in allergenic ways in allergic ways to exposure to spores, sinus issues, dermal reactions, itchy eyes, that kind of stuff. So high spore counts can be troubling. They also can carry mycotoxins, which is the byproduct of mold growth that only certain molds produce under certain circumstances. But mycotoxins get a lot of bad press.
Yes. I mean, there's so many tests out there, right, for mycotoxins, and that's one of the main things that people talk about.
It's almost all they talk about. I think it's a red herring. I don't think it's a red herring. It is a red herring. In fact, it's a distraction from the actual issue. It also completely ignores the fact that some molds produce mycotoxins, and even the ones that do, including Stachybotrys, the notorious black toxic mold, which is, by the way, green, not black, it only produces mycotoxins during stress or high periods of high competition. And so so we build this whole medical approach around detoxing mycotoxins. But what about all the molds that don't produce mycotoxins? That was this philosophy would assume that the other molds are benign and nothing could be further from the truth. And so the third thing that molds produce when growing, and all molds produce this when they're growing, is the musty smell. And the musty smell, known as microbial volatile organic compounds, or short MVOCs, are getting a lot of attention now, thankfully. I've been talking about this for 20 years because the dogs that we use during inspections are trained to sniff at the source of those microbial VOCs. And so we would go into houses where there would be significant symptoms. People were very sick. We'd take air samples. They may have normal spore counts, but there's a strong musty odor. And we do the remediation, we oversee the remediation, do the testing at the end. Spore counts still seem normal, but the musty smell is gone. Everybody feels better. And I saw that happen hundreds of times over the course of 20 years. And so now the research is very clear that the microbial gases, the musty odor, have incredible health consequences. It's the second leading indicator of childhood asthma behind maternal smoking. It increases the risk for asthma in children by 250%. Just having a baby exposed to the musty odor increases their risk of developing asthma by 250%. There's wonderful research being done by my friend, Dr. Joan Bennett at Rutgers University, who wants to rename the volatile organic compounds associated with mold. Instead of MVOC, she wants to call them volatoxins, because she's doing research on fruit flies and exposing them to the musty odor. And she's finding that they stop producing dopamine. They fly downwards away from the light. They stop reproducing. They develop Parkinsonian-like symptoms. In essence, they become depressed and they develop cognitive issues, which is a very common complaint for mold sufferers. They blame it on mycotoxins, but I'm here to tell you that in my experience, after doing thousands of assessments, all health-driven, many of them referred by their physicians, that the musty odor is pervasive in all of these cases. Toxigenic molds here and there. Spore counts, sometimes high, sometimes not. And most of the time you've got a sweet spot where there's in chronic dampness, you'll have the toxigenic molds. You'll tend to have enough humidity that you'll have high spore counts and you'll have the musty odor. And those people are getting sort of a triple whammy. There's a really disproportionate amount of attention directed towards mycotoxins, as if the color of the mold or the type of mold dictates how you handle the mold. And again, nothing could be further from the truth. Mold is a moisture problem. And when you have those kinds of molds that are producing mycotoxins, by the way, that's a sign that you have not listened to the early signals, because that's late stage chronic dampness.
Wow.
So those are the tertiary colonizers. Those are the last guys to show up to the party. That means that you didn't listen when they first showed up.
Right. Wow. This is so interesting. And I have to say, I am someone who definitely has a very sensitive nose. So I go in somewhere and if there's even the slightest little bit of a musty smell, I'll smell it. I'm like, do you smell that? And most people are like, no, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, there's something moldy here. I smell it. Like, and this is, you know, sometimes in basements, but sometimes it could be just in other people's homes or at restaurants or, you know, schools and things like that. And I was always told, well, there's no mold we checked, right? I'm like, but there's a musty smell, right? So they're like, well, the spore count is fine. So this really, really makes so much sense what you're explaining, because it's all of these things and, you know, the musty smell and these volatile compounds that come from that are really, really important and people aren't talking about them. So this is so, so important to know. So my next question then is, if let's say someone has an issue where they smell a musty smell, right? And they may have had water damage, or maybe they haven't, or they don't know, right? If they're moving into a home and they don't know what happened 5 years ago or 10 years ago, what are the best ways that they can test and find out? Because I know that there's many different testing labs out there. And of course, you can have a technician come, but I feel like the field is just, it's such a big field, you know, and people have different training. And so someone can take, like you said, an air sample and say everything is fine, but is it really fine? Is there really a good test?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a question that I've heard thousands of times. And you know, my company is called 1-800-GOT-MOLD, and we do mold inspections and remediation consulting. You take tens of thousands of calls over the years, and one consistent refrain is, "That sounds expensive. Is there a test kit on the market?" So if you look at the spectrum of what's out there, you've got basically these $10 petri dishes at the checkout at the hardware store, which are fundamentally they're basically a sixth grade science fair experiment. They're scientifically invalid. They're good to, you know, if you're concerned about mold growth in your home, the first thing you should not do is grow more of it, which is what they encourage you to do.
Got it. Makes sense.
All petri dishes will grow mold. That's what they're designed to do. Mold spores are ubiquitous. They will settle out of the air. So the presence of spores does not mean that you've got a mold problem. There's a big difference between having mold, which every house does, because every surface does, mold spores, and mold growth, or a mold problem where you've got a real moisture condition that's causing active growth. Those are very, very different things. So the question about the test kits, the $10 test kits at the checkout, those sort of anchor the darkness, if you will. And people buy hundreds of millions of dollars a year worth of those. It's a terrible waste. And then all the way on the other side, you've got very expensive inspectors, many of whom are capitalizing on this mycotoxin thing. And they will do all sorts of weird tests. They'll often use tests that are not recommended, like ERMI.
Yes. Oh, I could tell you stories about that. We'll get into that later. But yeah.
Bad news. And these guys that are charging, some of these guys are charging $5,000 or $6,000 for an inspection. And then they're handing someone over $100,000 remediation proposal.
Right. And I've even heard things where people are saying, you know, unfortunately, I had this happen to a neighbor of mine. They had the ERMI done, and they basically were told that everything in their house is bad. And for lack of a better word, they need to basically knock their house down. I mean, they didn't say it in that way, but it was basically like, it's everywhere. And by the way, you also have to get rid of everything you own, like your clothes, your couches, your everything.
It's craziness. I've heard this for 20 years. Most of what we've done is we spend time talking people down from the ceiling. Of all of the houses we've gone in, I have only one time said this is not habitable. Now, that doesn't mean I have not recommended that people find alternative living arrangements while the problem is corrected. But to say that a building is uninhabitable is a very different conversation. And to say that all of your belongings are quote unquote contaminated is to misunderstand contamination. It's also to misunderstand what remediation is. Remediation is not about killing things. It's not about removing mycotoxins. It's about cleaning. You remove the building materials that support the fungal growth, and you clean the surfaces. Mycotoxins are not freely floating around. They're little oily substances, and they're very little. They're measured in nanos, but they're on dust and they're on spores. And so you clean up the dust and the spores, and guess what you've done? You've cleaned up the mycotoxins. There is no additional treatment needed for that. And we can talk more about remediation techniques and why, talk about chemicals and all that kind of stuff a little bit later. But on the testing piece, you've got the $10 test kits, and you got these $6,000-$7,000 maniacal fear-based inspections. We also have our professional inspections are about $1,000 to $1,500 on average. And that includes a full written report. In the middle between that $10 and that $1,500, which is the marketplace, there's a lot of junk science, good scientific idea, poorly applied. And so what we've basically looked at is there's two kinds of mold problems you can test for. One of them would be what some people call hidden mold. I'm starting to call it more sequestered. Hidden mold just means that you can't see it. Sequestered for me is it's away. It is literally not part of the same space. So the stuff that would be growing in a wall, that's sequestered or hidden mold. That mold is going to produce VOCs and the musty odor, but not spores. So there's a different kind of test kit. And we actually really like a product made by a company called Home Air Check, or actually Prism Analytical is the company, or now they're named, I think, Enthalpy, Enthalpy. But the website is homeaircheck.com. And they have a VOC test kit that will test for man-made VOCs, which are also a major problem in modern buildings, as well as microbial VOCs, which are the byproducts of active growth.
And the man-made you're talking about, those are things like if people have like varnishes on their floors, right? And things that the wood is treated with and paint. Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm.
That's right. Anything that you get from any of the big box stores is going to off-gas to some degree, it seems. Mm-hmm. Whether it's furniture, finishes on your floors, walls, you know, insulation in the walls, unfortunately, in many homes is made with formaldehyde. So VOCs in modern buildings are a real problem, especially in America. Scandinavia, they've regulated that for a long time, and they don't have that issue. But we just love our fast, cheap stuff, and fast, cheap stuff off gases. And it's because of the adhesives and plastics and all the stuff, all the packaging even. You know, we're living in a chemical soup. If you saw the number of chemicals that are in your air, you'd be shocked. And some of them are really disconcerting. So this test will tell you what your chemical load is in your house. So it's a really useful overall view on the gases and the VOCs in your home.
And it differentiates between the regular VOCs and these microbial ones that could be from mold?
Yes, it does. And that's the best part about that test. And I am unaware of any other such test in the industry that does that.
That sounds really neat.
Yeah, so I recommend them. The other kind of test kit that's out there that's actually valid uses the same professionals. Actually, we make one. That uses the same devices that professionals use called spore traps. And that's looking for a different kind of mold problem. That's the kind of mold problem that's growing on surfaces on the inside of your building. So on exposed surfaces. Now, those exposed surfaces might be underneath the bottom of dresser drawers. It might be underneath furniture, but they're still exposed surfaces within your airspace, if you will. And those mold problems, which are often caused by prolonged periods of elevated humidity, those mold problems, and yet that you'll see that you'll tend to have visible mold in areas. You know, a well-experienced, well-trained professional will find those kinds of problems fairly quickly. They tend to be low underneath furniture, on the backsides of dressers and outside corners, cold closets, things like that. That's from just having too much moisture in the air or from having something get wet and stay wet for too long. Those kinds of mold problems will create high spore counts. And so you basically are looking at, much like COVID testing, there's different kinds of COVID, every kind of test, really, there's different ways to sort of look at the data and gather a perspective from the methodology you use. And so we like to pair them together because if you really want to get a holistic picture of what's going on in your air, you need to look at the gases and the spores, or the gases and the particles. And so I like to suggest that people get a spore trap based test kit like ours, which we sell at gotmold.com, and the VOC test kit. And when you have them together, you can quickly see not only if you have a problem, but the type of problem you have. Is this a problem that's hidden in the walls, or is this a problem that's actually growing on the surfaces in my airspace?
That's so helpful. I never really thought about it looking from both angles, but that makes so much sense. That's great. And that's really great resources for everyone to have. Then once someone does the test and they see that it comes up for something, either the spores or the microbes or both, what's the next step? Where do they go from there?
Unfortunately, we have not yet figured out a way to create a consumer-friendly, low-cost way to do your own remediation and or even to do a proper inspection without the benefit of having some professional experience there on site. So even with our test kit, what we recommend is that if there's any alert conditions detected using our kit or any other test kit for that matter, the best next step is to hire a professional. And the key element there, though, is to hire an independent, qualified professional who has specialized experience in mold and mold remediation, that does not have a financial relationship of any sort or kind with a remediation firm. Of course, you're depending on them to attest to that and be honest about it. But that is so important. I cannot emphasize that enough.
I could certainly understand that, because I can definitely see the relationship being a problem in a lot of different ways, for sure. So what types of questions can people ask the person that they're potentially looking into to do the inspection, just to know that they're going to be good? So, you know, we can ask them, as you said, that they don't have an affiliation specifically to a remediation company. Is there anything else that we would want to know?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's funny you should ask that. We know we made a welcome page on our website for your listeners, and it's at gotmold.com/mysteriessolved. And on that page, we have an ebook called How to Find Mold, that has a bunch of frequently asked questions and includes in there how to hire an inspector, what to ask and what to look for. And so that's a free resource available to your listeners.
That's great. Yes. And we're going to put that landing page in the show notes for everyone to see. And then they could download that. That would be very, very helpful. And then once they have the inspector, and as you said, the inspector would not be connected to a remediation person or remediation company, how would they go about that? Because there's lots of companies, and as you mentioned before, some are very on the surface, some kind of go way to the other side and may not be needed. So tell us a little bit about what remediation is and what it isn't, and then how people can find the right person to remediate.
Okay. So I this is the first time I've announced this, but we're working on a consumer version of the industry standard. Right now it's locked away with the trade association. It's a copyright protected document. And so the consumer can't even get access to it unless they want to pay $75 to buy this, you know, this paper hefty, very technical guide. And so I think that's probably the underlying reason why there's so much confusion about the subject and why contractors are able to just go rogue and have no consequences, because the consumer doesn't know. They're not informed. And so we're working on remedying that through a combination of, you know, little guides, pamphlets, and also some explainer videos. In essence, remediation is about removal of mold and its byproducts. It is not about killing mold. It is not about killing mycotoxins. I love that one. Mycotoxins are not alive, never have been, so you can't kill them. But basically, in essence, mold remediation is a controlled interior demolition of affected materials, removal of such, and then a fine cleaning of all of the affected areas in the building. And then, of course, the most important part is the root word of remediation is remedy. You must fix the underlying moisture problem. And that actually should be done first or at the same time that the cleanup is done. Because if you don't, you know, this is the really important point, is that mold occurs within 24 to 48 hours of a moisture problem that isn't dealt with properly. And according to the industry standard, water damaged materials, porous water damaged materials that stay wet for 72 hours or longer are automatically considered moldy and should be removed regardless of whether there's visible mold on them or not. And so the guidance, the professional guidance, the industry guidance, talks about mold problems and reaction to them in matters of hours and days. Most homeowners or property owners or property managers tend to delay their reaction at least a few days. They think about it in weeks and months. Oh, I've only had that, but it's been that way for a while now. But it moves very, very quickly. And a water damage problem is very cheap to fix, by the way. Mold is very expensive. So the faster you move on that, the less you have to involve, you know, significant budget, outside contractors. By the way, as soon as it goes from 24 to 48 to 72 hours, you can no longer have your handyman or your local guy, your dad, or even yourself do it. You have to engage a professional to do removal of anything more than 10 square feet. And I even think that's too much.
Okay. So if it's right away, yes, you can remove the little bit of sheetrock or a little bit of the ceiling. But if it's past 72 hours, then it's really not a DIY type of project.
That's right. If you can get wet sheetrock, if you can get to something within the first day, wet sheetrock, and you don't have the tools to dry it out, which of course most people don't, cut it out.
Now, can you just put a fan on it, or that's not enough?
The thing about water in a wall is if the wall's got insulation in it and that wall insulation got wet, the insulation will never dry. And so it just depends on the dynamic. Again, this is why professionals are necessary. Finding a qualified remediation contractor is almost as hard as finding a qualified inspector. It's true. And it's a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are a lot of mistakes that are made in the industry that are repeated by contractors who just are not, they're IICRC certified, but they're not actually following the standard at all. For example, fogging is not in the standard. It's addressed to not do it. It's specifically addressed as a not recommended practice.
May I ask why? Only because that's something, and again, I'm not a mold expert, that's why I have you on, but you know, it's something I definitely hear about, and people sometimes even buy foggers and special solutions. I mean, there's so many things, some are natural, some are not, but you know, it's such a big thing that people talk about. Can you tell us a little bit more about why that's not recommended, and is it making it worse, or is it just not making it any better?
Well, first let me tell you why they do it, okay? The first is they use it because it precipitates the particles. So in other words, what it does is you create this mist. And there's something called agglomeration where these particles will gather together. And by virtue of them getting larger, the mass increases and they fall out of the air. So basically, the idea is fogging done well, if you can say that, should basically clear the air, so to speak, and allow the surfaces to be cleaned. The thing is that the fundamental misunderstanding or the sort of the flaw in the logic about fogging in the first place is that you have to, most of the time there are antimicrobial components to this fog. They're trying to kill something. The fact is that there is no place, when I say zero place, no place ever for antimicrobials during mold remediation, unless you're concerned about bacteria. Like if there was a sewage leak, or you've got, you know, river water or something like that has a high nutrient content that could potentially have, or could have a lot of microbes in it. Those circumstances should be treated with sanitizing agents to because of the concern about bacterial infections or viral. There's other critters in there that you got to worry about. But when it comes to mold remediation doesn't need chemicals. And I have a very hard time finding contractors that will even listen to this, by the way. Even though, by the way, that's also in the industry standard.
Wow.
So keep in mind that oftentimes when you use chemicals, some of these chemicals leave a legacy behind. Some of them are harmomodulating. There are quaternary ammonias, which actually dry out. And there's evidence and research that says that once it dries out, it becomes dust, it becomes airborne, and it lodges in your cells, and it can actually cause harmomodulation and estrogen dysregulation and all sorts of wonderful things like that. So antimicrobial. So the idea is that you spray a toxin onto something that you don't need to kill. The toxin stays behind. And oftentimes the contractor thinks that they've just killed the mold, so they don't need to remove it. So now you've got a high fungal load and a high chemical load. Congratulations.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Because I guess what you were saying, like if it's making the spores or like the mold kind of fall, you know, because you said that it's going to be larger, right? So it falls down. So they have to almost like clean it up from the floor, right? But they don't. So
that's right. And that's the way remediation is done. So the way remediation is done is you go in, you identify the areas of water damage. You remove, for example, sheetrock, carpet padding, ceiling tiles, anything that's been damaged or where there's growth. So anything that's staining, and you remove within 2 feet of those materials. You leave behind structural elements and anything that isn't damaged. And this is all done under containment and negative air pressure. So this is to control the dust. Fungi-laden dust is nasty stuff. So, of course, everyone doing the work has to wear proper protective equipment because low spore counts before remediation will become very, very high spore counts during remediation as well. And so all of that work in containment under negative air pressure to control the dust, they'll then do fine cleaning after that. They'll vacuum up everything using HEPA-filtered vacuum cleaners and wipe everything down. This is where they want to use chemicals and sprays, but they don't need to. Just a damp wipe and with a detergent mix is perfectly sufficient. It's elbow grease. This is the biggest problem with remediation contractors. They don't want to do the work. They want the pay. They don't want to do the work. They want to spray something or fog something. And they want to have it smell good. They want to paint something. They want to paint a surface so that it looks like it's been treated, all that stuff so that the consumer is happy. But all those things are unnecessary costs. They leave behind a smell. They leave behind a chemical. And they also don't get to the heart of it, which is remove the fungi, remove the mold, vacuum it up, wipe it down. So it's HEPA, wipe, HEPA. That's the mold remediation mantra. HEPA, wipe, HEPA. And you do that 4 or 5 times, and then you do it 3 more just for good measure. And you're also running air purifiers, HEPA filtered air cleaners the entire time. And then even after they're done cleaning, we leave them on for 2 days, and then we turn them off for 24 hours before we test. That the byproduct of mold remediation should be a white glove clean space with zero odor, zero chemicals, zero residue, no paints, no encapsulants. You don't need to add antimicrobial paint or anything, because if you fix the water problem, it's not going to grow back.
Right.
If you didn't fix the water problem, it'll grow on the antimicrobial paint within 6 months. Just give it time. Mold always wins. So there's no point in doing that. Plus, you're adding a line item. You're adding expense. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, it does. So then in terms of the air, because I understand what you're saying in terms of not using foggers, that makes complete sense in terms of cleaning it and wiping it. And I know you're doing it under negative pressure, but let's just say that someone has, you know, say it's in their basement, right? Or maybe like in a crawl space. And typically for many people, their air conditioners or their heating units are also in those spaces. So then, because the mold, even though it wasn't growing in the ducts, let's just say, maybe because there was spores and some of these volatile compounds, could they have gone into other areas, right? Because I know you're doing it at a negative pressure in that space, but what if the spores got into the ducts or, you know, and then they went upstairs from the basement? How would you address that? Because you're using the HEPA filters, but you're using it in the space where the mold was, not everywhere else. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So one of the things we test for spores, right? I mean, I our got mold test kit is a spore trap test kit. But I must remind people, I'm not in the camp that spores are what make you sick. I use spores as a measure of as a way to know more about the problem. Also, spores are a great way to know if the space has been cleaned. Spores are microscopic dust, and I can connect it to a specific origin because mold doesn't grow in the air. It grows on a surface. And so I use the spores as a way to measure, you know, the degree of contamination, the degree of a mold problem. So, you know, we test the whole house in most cases. And, you know, the area, you test the area of concern where mold is clearly present and where remediation will occur regardless. And then you test the non-complaint areas where there's nothing visible because contamination can occur beyond that. And that those areas need to be taken into consideration as part of the overall remediation. So that would mean running air purifiers and HEPA vacuuming and wiping down those areas too.
In those areas too. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Including ductwork needs to be cleaned. There's a standard for that. The NADCA, NADCA, Mechanical Hygiene System Standard. And so, you know, getting your air ducts cleaned by someone who's NADCA certified is always a good thing. But, you know, I'm not in the camp that we can't be away from spores. Let me give you a fun statistic. There's a great book, by the way, called The Entangled Life. Anybody who's interested in fungi will find that to be amazing. It's written by a guy named Merlin Sheldrake. Beautiful, beautiful book. And he quotes that there are the kingdom fungi releases 50 megatons of spores into the environment every year. 50 megatons is the equivalent of 500,000 blue whales.
Wow.
So it is kingdom fungi is the largest producer of biological particulate on the planet. We are not going to get away from spores.
Right.
So, but the thing is, what we want to do is make an environment which is not conducive to their growth and proliferation indoors. And so we use testing for spores to determine the extent of the problem, where it needs to be cleaned up, and then also to assess whether or not it has been cleaned up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So then what about the MVOCs? Because as you mentioned earlier, this is the stuff that can really make people sick, even more so than mycotoxins or the spores, as you say. And I'm just playing devil's advocate, I guess, a little bit, but is it possible that, let's just say someone had water damage or issues in their basement, it was musty there, but again, the ducts are there, right? Their heating system or their air conditioning system is there. It went through the ducts into the other parts of the house. And then the must, even though the basement's cleaned up, could the musty smell still be in other areas?
Well, so the good news about the musty smell is that it's airborne. And so as soon as you ventilate, it's gone. If it's not being produced, it does absorb into porous materials. Everybody can relate to, you know, the idea of like a musty book, right? The book may not be moldy, but it's got a musty smell. You know, you look at the book and it looks fine, but it's because the paper will absorb that odor. So porous materials will absorb that odor, clothing. That's why people who live in moldy houses sometimes smell musty. You know,
yeah,
it'll absorb into their clothing. And so that musty odor can be, you know, that can be washed out of clothes, by the way.
Okay. So that's something that isn't going to make you sick then, right? If you wear that clothes or if you read that book because there's no mold on it, or can it?
A lot of people will react to that and they'll think they're reacting to mycotoxins. Oh. This is the thing.
Okay.
Is that everyone, by the way, people also think mycotoxins are radioactive or something, as if they're in the wall, they're going to get you. These are, you have to have contact. There's a lot of misunderstandings around mycotoxins. Let me also clarify something here. People get sick from mycotoxins, okay? Mycotoxins are not to be messed with. I have leaned over to take a sample of a tape lift from a really infested wall. It had black, dense mold growth that was about a quarter of an inch off the wall, furry. And it was up 3 or 4 feet. It was an entire basement. And I went in there in the arrogance of my early years as a mold assessor, went in there without a respirator. And I leaned over and I felt, you know, that little bit of blood pressure rise in my face. And as I leaned over, my face, my nose bled out. It just bled out. Like,
oh my gosh.
And that's one of the symptoms of trichothecene exposure, is that it's hemorrhagic. It will break capillaries. And so that's why the whole story about the Cleveland Clinic and the kids who got sick back in the 90s, a bunch of babies came into the Cleveland Clinic after a flood, 2 weeks after a series of floods in Cleveland. And the babies were limp and bleeding from their orifices. And obviously everyone was scared to death. And the results were kind of inconclusive. That people blamed toxic mold, and CDC said that it's probably something else. But I had that experience. So mycotoxins are serious. Mycotoxins are used in chemical weapons. The T2 toxin used between Iran and Iraq was a kissing cousin of the same trichothecene that Sacubitril makes. So make no mistake, these are very potent chemical toxins that should not be taken lightly. I'm just saying the vast majority of illness that is blamed on mycotoxins is incorrect in my experience. So that's the good news. And I think that is good news, because mycotoxins, our relationship with them is poorly understood. You know, we use mycotoxins to cure disease too. Antibiotics are mycotoxins. And I believe that also causes a lot of sensitivities in people who have had used antibiotics to treat things like Lyme disease, and then wonder why they end up with a mold sensitivity when they just took gargantuan concentrated doses of mycotoxins to treat their Lyme disease. So these things are all kind of inextricably connected. And so my whole philosophy is that the buildings that we live and work in are essentially extensions of our immune system. So in other words, it's an exoskin or an exoskeleton that you live in. And I would even argue that the building, you have a symbiotic relationship with your building. It's here. It will protect you as long as you protect it. If you take care of the building, it will take care of you. In fact, the longevity of the building is largely, it has a birthday, by the way, and it also may have a death day. And its longevity is determined by how well it's cared for. And when the building gets sick, you get sick. The building heals, you heal. I would argue that the most important relationship you might have might be the one with the building that you live in, the one that you take for granted so often, and you think about this inanimate thing. But in fact, there's a sense of mutualism there, that you require each other to survive.
So then going back to, and it makes sense what you're saying about mycotoxins, that it's not produced by all molds, but if it's there, it is an issue. But then with the MVOCs and that sort of musty book or musty clothes, even after the remediation has been done and mold has been removed and cleaned, for some of the sensitive people, my canary, so to speak, right, that still react, they read that book and they start to maybe sneeze or feel like they have brain fog or just kind of feel off. Does that mean then that that book needs to be cleaned or, you know, potentially thrown out?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is that moldy materials that are not of great financial or sentimental value should be disposed. If when in doubt, throw it out. Okay. But that's not to say wholesale, right? You don't just go wholesale. Anything that's porous and absorptive, especially if it's got an odor or if it's been water damaged or visible mold growth, should just be disposed of. You can clean some things, but the question always is it worth it? You know?
Right. So, well, speaking about cleaning, and I know this may be a trick question, but is there a good mold kind of cleaner for porous things, right? So obviously you said it with countertops and things like that, all you need is just a damp cloth and some soap. But clothing, for example, I mean, do you just wash it in detergent, or is there, you know, because you see there's so many different things on the market that are called, you know, mold killer, so to speak. Is there such a thing? Are there good ones?
Most of the time, the smell, unless mold has grown on it, and it's hard to make that assessment. Oftentimes, these things are best removed with dry cleaning. Or with laundry, but not with typical sort of, you know, perchloroethylene dry cleaning with like carbon dioxide or with an organic cleaner. And I don't mean organic chemicals. I mean, you know, a healthy dry cleaning. They tend to be very effective at removing odors. And in some cases, actually, I've seen with, you know, expensive materials where it can actually be removed well without much damage. It just depends on the material and how much time someone's willing to invest in it. But in most cases, a good hot wash and a good hot dryer, if the mold has not actually grown on the material, will usually remove any of the odor if it's just absorbed from ambient air. And also if there's sort of settled spores and fungal matter just from the ambient air, again, not growing on, that can be just washed off. I mean, just in the wash. Now, borax, if you want to get you know, if you want to get fancy with it. But it doesn't really require too much more.
Right, right. Because if it has the musty smell, right, then that would mean that it is the VOCs that are on it, or at least that it was near those, right?
I would argue that if you wash something and it still has a musty odor, it's contaminated and it's garbage.
Got it. Okay. Good rule of thumb for sure. Now, when we talk about mycotoxins, and I think it's just so eye-opening what you were explaining about that and how not every mold produces it, but what about testing for mycotoxins in the body? I mean, it's such a popular thing and so many functional medicine practitioners do that. And there's many labs that will look at mycotoxins in someone's urine, which would in turn, in theory, right, show if they've had exposure to a mold, whether it's past or present, and that there could be an issue. And of course, there's different binders and different kinds of things that could be used for that. What is your opinion on that? And if someone has no mycotoxins, I'm assuming it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't have other mold exposure, right?
Yeah. So I, as you might imagine, I've got kind of a contrasting view on this too. I do believe, again, that mycotoxins have a place and they are a causal factor in some human disease. But in terms of the way this has become sort of an industry around testing and binders and all that stuff, I'm a big fan of root cause. Most mycotoxin exposure, in my estimation, is actually through food. For my own personal health journey, one of my solutions was a no sugar, no grains diet. If you look at the mycotoxin levels in the grains even in sugar, believe it or not, but in many of our imports and even peanuts and things like that, you'd be shocked at how high those levels are. Aflatoxin, there's an acceptable amount of aflatoxin in peanut butter, according to the FDA. And the best part about aflatoxin is that it's only the most potent chemical carcinogen known to man, aflatoxin B1. There's an acceptable level in peanuts, and that's coming, you know, from the same kind of mold that will grow on the sheetrock in your living room. And so many times people are being treated for mycotoxin exposure, and they're being told that their house is the issue. And a lot of people can't find the problem because the problem is in their diet, and they're eating a highly processed diet comprised of non-foods, primarily non-foods, wheat and then you exacerbate that by having it be a GMO non-food with it's got mycotoxins and glyphosate on top of it, right? So just pile it on, and we wonder why we have these inflammatory conditions. And so my suggestion is, in terms of root cause, is if you want to detox, first stop toxing. So that means remove exposure. And so if you have an air quality problem, you can do one of three things. You can either filter the air, you can remove the source, which is, you know, remediation, not always possible or practical. You can filter the air, which of course I do recommend. I think air purifiers are a required appliance in every single home.
Do you have a favorite?
I love Medify Air. I love IQ Air too. They're a bit too expensive these days also bulky, and they haven't really changed too much, but that's a great the Health Pro Plus is a great all around workhorse. I have them throughout my house, but I also love Medify Air. They're lightweight and they're very inexpensive, but they're powerful. And they also look really nice. And they're quiet. And so I'm a big, big fan of that company. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on Austin Air or Air Doctor? Because those are two popular ones that people talk about a lot. Do you think those work?
Yeah, they're good filters. A true HEPA is the most important thing you're going to look for, because if it doesn't say true HEPA, it isn't. And what is not true HEPA, that means air actually will bypass the filter. The other component of a really good air filter is that you want to have enough activated carbon in it to remove the VOCs, because healthy indoor air is not just low on particles, mold spores and combustion byproducts and things like that, but also low on gases and the VOCs, whether they're man-made or not. Those can only be removed either through ventilation or through filtration. And so the filter needs to be able to capture those. HEPA filters don't do it. You need to have the carbon in there, which actually chemically binds to the VOCs. And so that means that you also have to replace those filters pretty regularly. Otherwise, those VOCs will just pass through again. So I do like AirDoc. I think any filter is better than no filter, first of all. I don't care if you put a pleated filter on a box fan. seriously, that's a very effective way of reducing particles to an acceptable level if you have a small budget. But really, if you want to do the best you can for your air, you want to make sure there's a decent amount of carbon in that filter. So that you can have a more well-rounded perspective. Again, we're testing for these problems. We're looking for spores and VOCs. So when we're filtering, we're also doing the same thing. We're looking to take both of those things down. to an acceptable level. The third part, so that you can either do the source removal, you can do the air filtration, or you can dilute. Dilution is a more complicated conversation. That means, you know, you wouldn't really open the windows to deal with a mold problem, but you might open the windows to deal with, you know, an odor. You might want to ventilate a house if that's your only option right now, because you just listen to this podcast and you go, oh my God, I'm living in this musty. You might want to get some fresh air in there, but that's not a sustainable solution. And so ultimately, the most sustainable thing is obviously remediation. And the second most sustainable thing is air filtration.
As you can see, there's quite a bit to mold and certainly many misconceptions about it. Sometimes it can be worse than we think, but other times it may actually be not nearly as bad, especially when it comes to mycotoxins. In the next episode, which is going to be episode 118, Jason and I are going to talk about how the body actually deals with mold and the best ways to support it. As you can probably guess, there will be many more myths to bust and practical advice that you can use right away. So please stay tuned. And in the meantime, if Allison sounds like someone you know, or you know anyone that's dealing with mold, please share this episode with them. And please be sure that you subscribe to the show so that you never miss an episode. And as always, when it comes to your health issues, please, please don't give up. The answers are out there and there is hope. I'm Ina Toppler. Thank you so much for listening. And I will see you next time on Health Mystery Solved, where we continue this conversation.
All information, content, and material on this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and/or medical treatment of a qualified physician or healthcare provider.